are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, December 17th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Andro Del Blanco, professor of history at Columbia University, author of The War Before the War, Fugitive Slaves, and the Struggle for America's Soul from the Revolution to the Civil War. Also on the program today, Stephen Miller says Trump a hair's breadth away from shutting down the government over the wall. Meanwhile, a federal judge in Texas rules the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional. What happens next? We'll tell you today. Ryan Zinke forced to a fast getaway from the Interior Department with the cops on his trail. Meanwhile, Scott Walker signs the Wisconsin bill stripping the incoming Democratic governor of his power, and maybe named the next corrupt Secretary of the Interior following Zinke's getaway. And speaking of getaway, Paul Ryan's last push to prove he's a horrible human being wants to provide additional visas for the Irish. Lastly, California moves up its primary. It will change everything in the Democratic Party. We will tell you why. And lastly, walk away. Heats up. All this and more.
We got to stop doing segments on that, though.
Majority Report.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, seriously.
It's too much.
So many walk away. People don't even know what I'm talking about.
The most exposure they've ever gotten.
So quickly, let me say this. Over the weekend, I couldn't help myself. I think I mentioned at the end of the last week, we got a request from a guy. We had made a 10-minute video, approximately 10-minute video. As you know, we do about 15 hours a week of programming here, maybe a little bit less. About 15 hours, maybe a little bit less. And some as members, some as, for YouTube, some as for the free audio show, et cetera, et cetera. And several months ago, we did 10 minutes on this guy, Brandon Starka. I'm sorry, Brandon Starka.
I thought it was Stryka.
Some guy who claims to have trademarked the hashtag walk away. And it started the walk away movement, which, of course, what you always do is you start with trademarking the name of it. That's how you know it's a real organic movement.
First, go to the patent office.
MikeSermich.com.
And he... And we did a video, and I'm going to be totally upfront about this. We just basically mocked the video that he made and said that this guy is running a grift. And he became very upset about it, apparently. And 3-4 months later, after the Democrats won their biggest win in terms of votes in a midterm election ever, by percentage and by actual votes, ever. He's still trying to say that the walkaway movement is really working well and it's huge and it's changing everything. And, so he contacted us on Twitter and he was very upset that we were ignoring his, request to respond. And so, he's a struggling, actor, or I thought he was struggling. He's doing quite well now, apparently, but, that's
all going according to plan.
Yes, exactly. I said, okay, I'll come on your show and address it. And let me just say this. I try you've heard every interview I've done on this show, or maybe you haven't, but you know, when I invite somebody, I try and be as respectful as I can. I try not to be mean to anybody, usually. And unfortunately, this weekend, I was a little bit mean to him. I mean, I wasn't, you know, I didn't beat him up. I mean, it was all on the computer. But I was, I did not use euphemisms for what I sort of felt about what he was doing. And it was 90
you
minutes
revealed
long.
A certain character defect you have.
I revealed a certain personality defect. Yes, I was extremely straightforward for 90 minutes. And then also sometimes smug and condescending. And then also sometimes like, I don't want to say disingenuous, but so now
a little
look,
sarcastic.
You were genuinely disingenuous.
I don't know if he's going to put it up. I suspect he is, but I haven't seen it, and don't even bother looking for it because eventually you all get to see it. But in the meantime, we're going to include it for folks who donate through Patreon and for our members. So if you're a member or you're on Patreon, you will get this in your feed as soon as we get it uploaded. I can tell you that if you're skeptical of the entertainment value of this, everybody in the office was pretty enjoyed it, I think, more than they possibly anticipated. So,
that's true. It really exceeded expectations in terms of how funny it was.
It was extremely funny. I did not break character once. Oh, it was one moment at the end, I think, where Michael picked up on, like, he realized, like, I responded to something, and then I realized, like, oh, wait, I could do this in a funnier way. So you could... You can see my thought process. It's sort of like a part of like a, I built in the sort of the behind the scenes.
It was like coming to watch us do prep.
Yeah.
And you know what? That guy is delusional enough to think that he won that debate. So he'll probably
it's
post
possible.
It.
I think, I think he's,
I mean, I'm still
it's a marketing
on the fence.
Thing.
Yeah. Matt was texting me. He's like, I don't know if I can keep working.
This isn't good for Sam, guys.
This is bad for Sam. This is going to hurt all of us when Sam looks this bad.
I had no idea Sam was so smug. hey, folks. So if you want to join the Majority Report, now's the time to do it. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Sign up, and you will get this if you sign up in the next day or so, because we'll probably release it tomorrow. This is where I've been saying buy tickets to our live show for Brooklyn Podfest at the Bell House, January 13th. Too late. They're sold out. However, I got an email today from a listener. I have two tickets for the live show I can't use. If you send address, I will snail mail a hard copy to deserving recipients gratis. If you are a self-determined deserving recipient, send us an email. We will take the first one we get at majorityreporters@gmail.com. But the subject line has to be very specific. It has to say two, the numeral two, not the words two, the numeral two free tickets. Send your address and we will pass it on. Also, one of today's sponsors is privacy.com/majority. Privacy.com is a totally free service. It lets you buy anything online without having to give out your credit card number. And it lets you prevent companies from overcharging you. Here's how it works. You take just a couple minutes. You link your bank account to privacy.com account. Then you're able to create a virtual credit card numbers, which are linked to your bank account. You can create as many virtual cards as you want. You can delete them and freeze them and unfreeze them, and you can set limits on each card. It's great for signing up for free trials because you can just create a virtual card once and delete it, knowing you'll never be charged once the trial is over. It protects you when companies get hacked and people's information stolen because you're not going to give out your real credit card number. Each card is locked to a merchant, so you're totally protected against fraud and unauthorized use of your card. Privacy.com's mobile app and desktop browser extension make it incredibly easy to manage your wallet of virtual cards and allow you to autofill your virtual credit card number at the click of a button when you're shopping online. There are countless different advantages using a service like this to pay your bills and buy things online. You can find out more. And I will say this. I haven't quite figured out if I can swing this, but some of us have elderly parents. Sometimes they get caught in fishing expeditions. I haven't quite worked this out yet, so I don't know. You have to noodle around with it. But this is a perfect solution. This sounds like it could be a perfect solution. If there's a way I can manage it for my parents, I'm not going to get too specific from a distance. But you can find out more and get 100% free and unlimited access by going to privacy.com/majority. I put a link underneath this video if you're watching on YouTube. I put a link in the podcast description. Check it out. Also, one of today's sponsors is Skillshare. And the first 500 people, and I cannot guarantee that this is going to be available for much longer, because I have a feeling we have more. We're very close to that. I know, sometimes I say 500 people, and they're like, if you have 600 show up, they'll do it. But you go to Skillshare at skl.sh/majority. You're going to get 2 whole months of totally free access to Skillshare's entire library of super quality online courses and tutorials. Skillshare is a vibrant online learning community, offers courses on everything from design to video editing to photography to business to technology, cooking, meditation, everything in between. There are Skillshare courses for everybody. You'll have no problem finding courses that's going to be useful for you, both from like a business standpoint, from a personal standpoint, whether you want to sharpen your skills on something you already love doing, or you want to learn how to do something totally new. Skillshare has you covered. They have courses for entrepreneurs, courses on computer coding, web development, personal nutrition, learning languages, Photoshop, you name it. I've been checking out some of the cooking classes, particularly the knife use. I know that people are like, what? That seems very, but I'm not going to go out and I'm not going to go to a learning annex course to learn how to do a knife skill, but you pick up tips. It's very helpful. Like I say, I'm also going to learn some basic accounting going forward, maybe some Photoshop skills. Just think of everything you're going to have at your fingertips for 2 whole months. That's skl.sh/majority. skl.sh/majority. I put a link underneath this video and in the podcast description. Check it all out. All right. So the Trump administration is sending out the best that they have to offer to defend them against the sort of the latest revelations. And you know, Michael Cohen headed to jail. And really, I mean, at this point, if Donald Trump was not in office, they would go and arrest him. I mean, that's just the reality. And it's clear that the Southern District of New York, who pressed these charges against Michael Cohen, know that you cannot indict a sitting president. And so I think they're just going to go after the whole family on those narrow charges that are around the Trump business dealings. But here's Rudy Giuliani, fresh off of what, making millions of dollars from, who was it now? Like some oppressive regime.
Oh, he consulted all across the globe, but particularly he worked with just Latin recently. America.
No, but just recently, I feel like there was an African, I can't remember.
Equatorial Ghana? I'm not sure. Guinea? I'm not sure.
Somebody. Anyway.
There was a great show on this program about specifically his work to enhance police violence in Latin America that I did a couple
years. Oh, if you can enhance police violence, why wouldn't you? But here's Rudy Giuliani going out. God knows how much money he thinks he's going to make. Or really, it's the only way he gets on television, which ups his value with the other clients. I mean, going out and defending Donald Trump may not ultimately pay him anything because Donald Trump doesn't pay his bills. But what it does do is it signals to tyrants in third world nations, I'm your guy. I mean, the amount of money he's probably made off of that already is, I think, would blow the doors off of all. I think we would all be blown away. But here he is. Theoretically defending Donald Trump.
I don't believe so. But again, if Roger Stone gave anybody heads up about WikiLeaks leaks, that's not a crime. It would be like giving him heads up that the Times is going to print something. Once the crime, this is why this thing is so weird, strange. The crime is conspiracy to hack. Collusion is not a crime. It doesn't exist. I ran that office. I know what they
do. No, hold on for 1 second. I should tell you, this is a compilation of his time on ABC's This Week. Collusion is not a crime. There is no crime collusion. There is a crime conspiracy to defraud the United States by conspiring with other people to break any one or other laws, or, you know, whether it's disclosure or whatnot. And we've gone over this. You can go back and listen to anything that we've done with Marcy Wheeler. She explains that. But go ahead.
I know what they do.
Do you know how the Southern District is run? You know exactly how the Southern District is run.
No, I don't know. I don't know how the Southern District is run. I'm disgusted with the Southern District. Southern District says you can get out of jail if you do this. He's got 3 years now. There's a real motivation to sing like crazy. He's got to do a lot of singing to get out of the 3 years. And he will say whatever he has to say. He's changed his story 4 or 5 times.
So has the president.
President's not under oath.
Did the president, did Donald Trump know that Michael Cohen was pursuing the Trump Tower in Moscow into the summer of 2016?
According to the answer that he gave, it would have covered all the way up to November of 2016. Said he had conversations with him about it. The president didn't hide this. They know.
Well, earlier they had said those conversations stopped in January 2016.
Until you actually sit down and answer the questions and you go back and you look at the papers and you look at the trend, you're not going to know what happened. That's why lawyers, what? You know, prepare for those answers.
Wait, what? You can't ask me about dates when I haven't sat here and like prepared which lie I'm going to tell about it.
Let alone asking somebody who didn't finish law school about dates.
Exactly.
It's just unseemly.
It's unseemly.
I remember when Giuliani was doing mafia cases and they would be like, hey, Mr. Giuliani, I never went to law school. I'm sorry.
I didn't.
I don't know about the dates right now. Okay.
I don't know about the
dates.
Which dates are we talking? There's a lot of dates.
A lot of dates.
A lot of dates.
How many
What's
days
the big deal
been?
With the dates? Why are you so up on top of the dates? good for you, Mr. Giuliani. You never prosecute anybody who lied to federal officials when he was a U.S. attorney. Was he in the Southern District? I know he was a USA. I can't remember.
Yeah,
where
I don't
was.
Know what district he.
Is Southern District the one that was reading Breitbart like during the 2016 campaign?
No, that's the FBI. FBI in the New York FBI office. There are multiple jurisdictions for U.S. attorneys in New York State because it's big. Most states have maybe one U.S. attorney's office.
Yeah, but he rescued us from all that unlawful dancing, so
that's right.
Can't be too hard on
that's
him.
Right. We there was a lot of victories there. Rudy Giuliani, you don't see people cleaning windshields anymore because of Rudy. Meanwhile, at over at Morning with Maria on, is this Fox Business? Yes, Maria Bartiromo, when she is not genuflecting to power, she is pretending that she doesn't, that she actually knows what she's talking about. And the resident buzzkill, Judge Napolitano, was sent on Morning with Maria. You'll recall the last scene on Fox and Friends, basically making Steve Ducey and Brian Kilmeade cry while Ashley Ainsley, is that her name?
Ainsley Earhart.
That is her
name.
Ainsley Earhart.
Ashley Ainsley, goddammit.
Ainsley Earhart didn't know necessarily what was going on. I'm not sure Ducey knew what was going on either, but Kilmeade clearly was upset. And here is Judd Napolitano to basically tell Maria Bartiromo, yeah, no.
Right. When he says he doesn't remember anything.
What he said at the 92nd Street Y, I think, was damning. Judge, yes. What do you think? He says, we did it this way with Michael Flynn, but we couldn't have gotten away with doing it that
way. Pause it. What she's talking about is Comey, I think he was at the 92nd Y doing an interview, and he was explaining how it is that they got in to sit down with Michael Flynn in the Situation Room, and he said, you know what? The procedures in other administrations would have blockaded us, but nobody stopped us. And, you know, I got news for you. Police officers of all stripes, they will go and do stuff that's not illegal. But if you don't exercise your rights to say, like, they'll come and they'll say, you know, can we open up your trunk and look at it? And if they have no probable cause, all they need is for you to say yes. And even if you think like, oh, I have to say yes, but you don't, they'll go and open it up, and that's perfectly legal. Now, every single person on this set knows that. Not this set, but on that set with Maria Bartiromo. If there was ever a story of like, oh, the police came over and just by random said, hey, can we look in your trunk? And there was a body in there, or there was 10 kilos of coke or whatever it was. The driver said, you know what? I didn't know I could say no. No one on that panel would be like, can you believe the overreach by the police?
It'd be a good game, though. You could just say, yes, look in the trunk. And then the cops look and they see the body and they're like, well, you weren't technically supposed to do that. So
well,
like,
the thing is, if you say yes,
you entrap me.
Yeah, that
you entrapped me.
No, right. Even if you say yes,
if you say yes,
so, because you're taking advantage of how
Flynn
dim I am.
Just sat down, and the big complaint is that the FBI agents were friendly, and he didn't know because they were being so friendly that they were like there for a reason. They just thought like, oh, they came to visit me just to shoot the crap.
In my fantasy life, they entrapped Flynn the same way they do like vulnerable Middle Eastern teenagers, like with the like, there's a lot of money in kidnapping this Turkish
right.
cleric.
Right.
Want to do it?
And of course, they don't pretend like they're.
Ridiculous harebrained scheme.
They don't pretend like they're FBI agents. Anyways, here's a third.
We couldn't have gotten away with doing it that way in more organized administration. I figured because if they were so disorganized, let me just send a few agents over there.
It is almost
not the way you want your FBI director to operate.
I agree, but it is almost inconceivable that FBI agents would be roaming the halls of the West Wing. What the hell are they doing there? They should have been asked to leave. If they didn't have a search warrant, they had no business there. Hey, Mike, can we talk to you? We want to ask you a question. We already know the answer.
Right.
And then it ends up in an indictment.
Right. Which is why the journal called it entrapment. I know there's a debate about that.
I saw your interview with General Mukasey. In my opinion, he's absolutely correct. Though they trapped him, it is not entrapment. Mm. Entrapment is when you resist, and they push.
But they did trap him. I agree with that.
Right, I did agree. So in other words, they did something that has an actual legal meaning and is a defense, entrapment. No, they didn't entrap him. They sort of just like sort of tricked him a little bit, like they used police techniques. Right, that's what I meant. They used police techniques. So basically, yes, Michael Flynn lied, and they all want us to feel sympathy for this guy because there was no way he could have known that these FBI agents were going to hold him to the truth.
I wonder what JSOC units did in Iraq and Afghanistan. Was that entrapment?
Right, exactly.
Get the fuck out of here.
All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, Andrew Del Blanco on his book, The War Before the War, Fugitive Slaves and the Struggle for America's Soul from the Revolution to Civil War. Change my mind. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of American Studies at Columbia University, Andrew Del Blanco, the author of The War Before the War, Fugitive Slaves and the Struggle for America's Soul from the Revolution to the Civil War. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Thanks, Sam. Glad to be here.
Let's start with the, the seeds of this war before the war, I guess, predate the Constitution, but not necessarily as a, within the context of a specifically of a nation. But let's talk about the three non-mentions of slavery, I guess, in the Constitution that set up this dynamic that end up coming to a head 80 years later, I guess, 90 years later.
Right. Well, I think, you know, the starting point of the story I try to tell is that we have to not be squeamish about the fact that we were basically two countries when these delegates showed up in Philadelphia to try to forge a new nation in 1787. And the Constitution is therefore a very tricky and in some ways opaque document on the subject of slavery, because for one half of the country, slavery was the bedrock of the economy and the culture. White people really couldn't imagine a society that didn't sustain slavery. And in the other half of the country, slavery was becoming marginal and peripheral and was pretty evidently heading toward extinction. That doesn't necessarily mean, as some people might like to think, that all the folks up north were farsighted and moral and sympathetic and concerned about the rights of black people. I think it had more to do with the climate and the economy and the way history worked. But in any case, there were really two countries.
I just want to stop there for a moment.
Sure.
Because
sure.
I don't know if this is, you know, I don't feel like people appreciate this enough. And there really isn't, I mean, a huge amount of scholarship, it seems like, on how distinct these entities were. And just to add your point about it wasn't that the North was necessarily progressive when it came to the rights of blacks, but there was a difference between being you could very much be an abolitionist and a segregationist simultaneously. Probably at that point most were. But tell us, like, what can you just tease out a little bit more about the differences in those societies?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I think you're quite right. Look, a lot of historians would raise their eyebrows at what I just said, and they would point out correctly that the whole country was already economically interconnected, and as the 19th century went on, the northern banks were financing the plantations. With the coming of the Industrial Revolution, people in New England were, you know, there were factories weaving slave-grown cotton into textiles for domestic and foreign consumption. So there's no, I'm not making the case that Northerners were not implicated in the reality of slavery. They certainly were, but at the same time, you know, it was one thing to be an abolitionist, say, in Massachusetts or New Hampshire, where by the middle of the 19th century, the number of black people, of course, there were no slaves by the middle of the 19th century in those states, but black people were an extremely tiny portion of the population, whereas in states from Virginia down to South Carolina and Mississippi, in some cases, black people were the majority of the population. So there's no way, I think, to blink the fact, to evade the fact, that in terms of race relations and the presence of slavery as an everyday reality, these were what I'm calling two different countries. Now, if you want to go back to the question you asked about the Constitution.
Yes, please.
It's very notable, and many people have noted it, that the word slavery does not appear in the Constitution. It doesn't appear either slave or slavery. Does not appear in the Constitution until the passage of the 13th Amendment after the Civil War, which was designed to abolish and eradicate slavery once and for all, one of the great ironies of our history. But slavery is there, nevertheless. It's there, you mentioned three places. It's there in the clause that authorizes the Congress, after a 20-year waiting period, which was a sort of compromise deal that they struck, to regulate the importation of such persons as states may wish to import. Everybody knew that what that meant was that international slave trade could be prohibited after 20 years if the Congress so chose. And it should be said, by the way, a scholar as profoundly informed as W.E.B. Du Bois believed that most of the delegates at the Constitution thought that by pointing toward the end of the international slave trade, they were taking the first step toward the eradication of slavery itself. They turned out to be wrong about that for reasons we can discuss. Then the second place in the Constitution where slavery is not mentioned but is intended is, of course, the notorious Three-Fifths Clause, where the Southern states won the right, if that's the word, to count three-fifths of what they called other persons for purpose of apportioning representatives in the new Congress. Now, this is a tricky historical matter. A lot of people believe that that somehow meant that slave owners regarded black people as equivalent to three-fifths of a white person. In fact, that has it backwards. Slave owners would have liked to count slaves as full persons for the purpose of apportionment, because then they would have had more representatives in Congress and more political power in the new federal government. It was Northerners who didn't want to see slaves counted for that purpose. So the three-fifths compromise was a sort of splitting the difference in terms of political power.
And we should, to be clear on that too, it's the you have a whole segment of your population which have essentially no rights under the Constitution, and they would and no benefits from a federal perspective, or I would probably imagine even from a state perspective, right? And so there was from the South's perspective, it's like, oh, we can pad our numbers essentially.
That's right. That's right.
And the North was, you can't get those resources without having actual citizens.
Well, there are not many Northerners in the late 18th century who went that far to say exactly that, but your implication is right. So white Southerners wanted to count black people when it was in their interest to count them for their augmenting their political power, but they didn't want to count them as persons when it came to questions of what were their rights, if they were charged with a crime, did they have any right to participate in any way in the political process, or any right to be regarded as anything like the equal of a white person in society. That's absolutely right. And it's one of the, I mean, as a sort of literary type person, I'm interested in the way in which people have the capacity to deceive themselves and the way in which we live with contradictions in our lives. If you look at that document and you see how they use the word persons to refer to slaves, you get somewhere close to the inner contradiction of Southern society, because people like Jefferson, wasn't directly involved in drafting the Constitution, but James Madison certainly was, they understood that black people were persons. They understood perfectly well that the slave system was an effort to subjugate and reduce human beings to the status of property, and that it was completely at odds with all the ideals that were articulated in the Declaration of Independence. And yet, the political reality, the social reality, was that recognizing black people as persons in the late 18th century was just not something that was going to happen, because slavery was too deeply rooted in the Southern economy and Southern
culture. You wanted to maintain one country, I mean, the point of your book on some in some respects. All right, but we were talking about the third mention of slavery, because we will get to that dynamic in a moment. But the third section, the third mention of slavery is in Article 4. This article comes up in things like the ACA case, or, you know, this is we're all, basically around the Commerce Clause, right?
Yeah, well, the article you're referring to has come to be known as the Fugitive Slave Clause. And that's where the story that I try to tell in this book really, really begins. It was quite clear, I think clear both to Northerners and Southerners, that if they were going to stitch together what I'm calling two countries into one, they had to address the question of what would be done about enslaved human beings who wished to flee from slavery and pursue the possibility of freedom. That meant taking themselves physically from a state where slavery was legal to a state where it was not legal. And that raised all kinds of difficult questions as to how you would arbitrate that situation. So they wrote into the Constitution what I call a kind of intranational extradition treaty, sort of words that suggested, and I don't have it right in front of me, so I have to paraphrase, persons owing service or labor in one state cannot escape that obligation by seeking refuge in another state, but must be returned to the party to whom service or labor is due. That's pretty close to the exact words. And what you can hear in that, I think, is that it's a sort of legalistic language, and it's in the passive mode, that is, must be returned, but it doesn't say anything about who's going to do the returning. You know, I mean, who's going to enforce this clause? Is it going to be the local police department in Haverhill, Massachusetts? If some slave owner from Maryland shows up and says, hey, that guy working in your factory actually belongs to me, is it going to be the state authority? Or is it going to be the federal authority, which was very weak at the beginning of the Republic? So they put it in that Constitution. It was the first vivid example of, as it were, punting on the issue, kicking the can down the road, postponing the reckoning that would have to be made with slavery in this divided country. And the story that I try to tell in my book is how this became a more and more intense and irresolvable human problem for those who fled and for those who were fearful of fleeing because they knew they would be returned if the authorities could find them. A political problem as the border between the slave states and the free states became longer and more porous as the nation expanded westward. We weren't talking just about slaves fleeing from Maryland and Virginia to Pennsylvania, but from, say, Kentucky to Ohio. And a legal problem. What would be the position of the courts when an accused fugitive was brought into court on the grounds that the Constitution authorized slave owners to recover their, as they said, absconded. They used all kinds of euphemisms to describe slaves who had fled, absconded human property. And it's my contention in this book that, first of all, it's a story through which I believe, and I tried very hard to make it possible for readers to do this, I believe one can see the horror of slavery in a particularly vivid way when one comes to terms or tries to come to terms with what it meant to be born into slavery and to have the courage to take the risk to seek freedom. But I also argue in the book that you could see this problem as the fuse that led eventually to the Civil War. There are lots of reasons, of course, but I think this is an important one.
Yeah, and that's fascinating. And I want to talk about the sort of the statutory completion, I guess, of that Article 4. And I should just add, too, what I find really interesting about that clause is you can really see the bones of how they were negotiating, right? Like it sticks out from this in a way, and you can see that it is a compromise, and we'll talk about that the other compromise coming down the road. But what also strikes me is that clause. It says no person. I happen to have in front of me no person held to service or labor in one state under the laws thereof escaping into another shall, in consequence of any law or regulation therein. So New York State, not only from the perspective, there's a negative prohibition against a state, or basically a nullifying of any state law that would protect these people. Like you cannot pass a law that if you come into New York State, you are now, you know, a free, you are discharged from your responsibilities as a slave, I guess, is basically what it's saying.
That's exactly right. And I'm suspecting maybe you spent some time in law school.
I did, just one year.
There you go. Okay, so I got that right. But no, you're exactly right. And, you know, one of the stories I tell in the book that really jumped out at me when I first read it, there's this character named Pierce Butler, who was one of the delegates from South Carolina at the Constitutional Convention. And he's in Philadelphia in the 1790s where the Congress met. Now, Pennsylvania had passed a law that was precisely of the type that you just described. As early as 1780, they passed a law that said no person enslaved in another state brought to Pennsylvania who has been in residence for more than 6 months can continue to be regarded as a slave. But that person, under Pennsylvania law, is now a free person. And one sidelight on that is that none other than George Washington himself consulted the attorney general and got some private advice and said, look, if you're in Philly with your slaves, send them back to Mount Vernon after maybe 5 months and a couple of weeks and bring some others to help you out. And then you can bring the first contingent back because you will have the calendar starts over again. The clock starts over again. I'm not making that up.
It's like renewing your visa almost if you're from
that's
a different
right.
country. Yeah,
that's right. Anyway, so Pierce Butler is in Philadelphia and some members of the Pennsylvania Abolition Society show up at his door one day and they say, listen, we happen to know that you've got a slave living with you. Young man's name was Ben. He's been here longer than 6 months, so we're here to tell you that he's now a free man. And Pierce Butler says something very close to, I'm a citizen of South Carolina. What have the laws of Pennsylvania got to do with me?
And
there, in a nutshell, is the problem that you were just pointing to. And as you, I'm sure, know, during the course of the early 19th century, more and more northern states passed what they called personal liberty laws that had various implications that enslaved people would be emancipated by the clock or by other means. And so the collision among the states, between the slave states and the free states, just got closer and closer and more intense over this issue of whether slavery was a national right enshrined in the Constitution. I mean, this is what, you know, the slave owners by the 1850s were saying. There are all these federal territories. Who is the federal government to tell us that we can't take our slaves there? In the Constitution, our property rights are protected. So slavery is a national phenomenon. Just because you don't want it in your state doesn't mean that we can't bring our enslaved person to your state and do whatever we like with them for however long we want. And that became the issue that provoked the rise, ironically enough, of the Republican Party in the 1850s and led to the election of Abraham Lincoln.
Okay, and so as we move toward that time, as we move through time, these two, I guess, cultures, if you will, begin to have more and more conflict around this point in federal territories. I also imagine at one point someone looks at that section three, or I should say section two, clause three, and starts to question like, well, there's nowhere in the Constitution that specifies what held to service. What constitutes
right.
legitimate held to service? Like, you know, if you're contractually,
right.
it's not like people were signing contracts with slaves. So
well, that's another great point. In fact, Frederick Douglass himself, who was a pretty sharp guy, and he didn't go to law school, he had a good legal mind. He wrote a pamphlet in 1860, and it was all about that word due, D-U-E, in that clause. The person or party to whom service or labor is due. And Frederick Douglass makes a whole case and says, you know what? Service or labor isn't due to anybody because slavery is an illegitimate institution. So I'm reading this and I don't see anybody to whom service or labor or my service or labor is due, you know. So he tried to pull the rug out from under the clause that way. It was a little bit of a fancy legal argument that didn't win many converts, but it was an interesting point of view.
So walk us up. What is the next, in terms of the next big sort of like institutional reaction to that conflict? And by that, I mean, is it the fugitive slave laws? Is there a particular one which is the sort of the most prominent milestone on en route to where we get to, I guess, the ultimate conflict being the Civil War? Because I know at one point, because you mentioned that in the past we've interviewed Sven Bekaert and others who have written about the implications of cotton and particularly the northern benefit, the economy that was built on that. But there's a dynamic that you talk about in the book that is not unlike, you know, today when I go to, the children's store and I like, this is shirts, only $6. That's right, great. Right. It's because I don't see the slave labor that's involved in it. But there are institutions, there are institutional responses to this conflict that begin to make the North more acutely aware. And in fact, you know, this dynamic cuts across a lot right. of different issues. I mean, even climate change, people are saying, like, when we start seeing this stuff a little bit more often, like the wildfires, we're going to understand what's going on. There's a dynamic that takes place there between these two cultures in terms of slavery.
Right. Well, absolutely. There's a lot packed into what you just said. So let me try to unpack it a little bit. I mean, there are a lot of factors, of course. I mean, history is nothing if not complicated, that lead to the growing intensity of the collision between these two cultures, the rise of abolitionism in the North, and there are many ways to understand that. And as you pointed out, some abolitionists were very farsighted and believed not only in the abolition of slavery, but in the assertion of equal rights for black and white people living in a biracial society on equal terms. Other abolitionists were against slavery because they didn't want black people in their neighborhood. They didn't want slave owners to be able to bring their slaves to the federal territories and put them to work in competition with immigrant labor. Some of the recent immigrants to America in the 1840s, 1850s, Irish immigrants in particular to Boston and New York, were very filled with racial animus toward black people and regarded them as competitors for the jobs and the factories that they were trying to hold down. So it's a complicated story, but to pick up on the point you made about, you know, the analogy with today, going into the big box store and buying a $6 T-shirt and not thinking too hard about where it comes from, the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850, which is the heart of the story I tell, was an attempt by the Congress to solve this problem once and for all, to put teeth into that toothless clause of the Constitution. And it was a merciless law. It denied the right of habeas corpus to any accused fugitive. That is the basic right of the Anglo-American legal tradition to contest the legality of one's detention in open court. It denied the right to a jury trial. There was no right to testify in your own defense. It made it a federal crime for any citizen in the North to harbor or assist a fugitive. And it enlarged, it didn't quite create, but it enlarged a category called federal commissioners and gave these folks, who could be the local justice of the peace or the local sheriff, the full authority of a judge to hold a hearing, make a determination whether this person did in fact belong to the plaintiff who had come to bring him or her back, and then send him back without any semblance of due process. So when this law was passed in 1850, which was passed with the idea that it would hold the nation together, that it would keep that stitching from unraveling, it had exactly the opposite effect. You know, if ever there was a law of unintended consequences, that was it. Because what it did, and here's to your point, it made it clear finally and completely that Northerners could not pretend that slavery was somebody else's problem. Slavery was not a Southern institution. Slavery, in this sense, was a national institution, and now they were implicated in it directly. If a person who had lived in Boston for 5 minutes or 5 years or 10 or 15 years was pursued and identified as formerly a slave in another state, that person was put into chains, taken to the local jailhouse, and under the judgment of some low-level bureaucrat, put on a boat and sent back to Georgia or Virginia or wherever in front of your eyes. That made it harder to look away. And Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson, was kind of slow in coming to the active engagement in the anti-slavery movement. Put it this way, he said when he talked about New Englanders putting sugar in their tea or eating their dessert pastries, no one tasted blood in the treats. No one tasted blood in the treats. But the Fugitive Slave Law suddenly, you know, it kind of, it woke them up lived in a sensory way that slavery was actually right here in our backyard, and we're involved, and we have to come to terms with our future with respect to slavery. What are we going to do about this situation?
I mean, it's not a direct parallel, but I think there is an obvious parallel today when you read stories coming from around the country of, yeah, I was in favor of what ICE was doing until, Paul Gonzalez, who has had a dry cleaners down the street for 25 years, all of a sudden gets deported and leaves his entire family.
That's exactly right. I mean, I spend some time in upstate New York, and you drive around and you see all the young men and sometimes young women working in the gardens of the well-to-do folks or working in the back of the restaurant. And you know perfectly well that a great many of them are undocumented immigrants. And it causes, I hope it will turn out to be a productive confusion in the minds of some folks. It causes confusion in the minds of, let's say, old line Republicans who find that our present administration is characterizing all these people as dangerous, menacing, criminals, and so on and so forth, when the reality is that the local economy depends on them and they're living side by side with us as neighbors. And it's an inexact analogy with what happened in 1850, but there are some elements in common.
Wait, I mean, just describe to us or explain to us, because it may seem obvious in some respects, but it strikes me as maybe not so obvious, particularly at that time. Why was maintaining a unified country so crucial?
Well, it's another great question. And one way to start answering it is to say it wasn't so crucial in the minds of many Americans in the middle of the 19th century, including abolitionists. I mean, some abolitionists. We think of secession as a Southern phenomenon, and it was indeed the Southerners who acted on it. But there was a sentiment for secession in the North as well. Wendell Phillips, one of the leading radical abolitionists, was giving a speech in New Bedford, Mass, when he got a telegraph bulletin, which turned out to be a couple days too early, but nevertheless, that Fort Sumter had been fired on. And he gets impromptu, he gets up on the stage and says, listen, these people have every right, have as much right to pull out of this union as we did out of the British Empire in 1776. He says, Mr. Lincoln has no right to a soldier in Fort Sumter. Let them go. Now, one reason that people like Frederick Douglass and Lincoln himself were adamant about the preservation of the Union was because there was a very real possibility that if the South had been allowed to go peacefully, which might have happened in 1850, because at that point there was much less sentiment in the North to take military action. If the South had been allowed to go peacefully, there was strong sentiment in the South to expand a slave-based empire by going deeper into Mexico than we had gone after the Mexican War, going into the Caribbean, annexing Cuba. That in fact the secession of the South could have been good news for slavery. Now, the historians will argue about that. It's one of those counterfactual questions. We'll never know. But it was certainly a sentiment in the air. And Lincoln, who was a very complex figure in this story, always believed that the destiny of the Union was the extirpation of slavery, that the Union, that the growth and expansion of the Union would mean that slavery, one way or another, would have to go out of existence. So although it is true, and many historians will say this, and I say it too to some degree in the book, that when the Civil War began, it was much more a war to preserve the Union than a war to destroy slavery. Those two motives or those two missions were very close together in the minds of a lot of Unionists, including Lincoln. Go ahead.
But that doesn't necessarily answer the question. I mean, it's a counterfactual that not only would slavery have not died out with, over at least of a projectable period of time had the had the country split in half in 1850, that there's every reason to believe that the institution of slavery would have been exported through, I guess, what we could call like colonial imperialist desires of the South.
That's right.
They'll go. Mm-hmm. They'll get more resources, and they're gonna need more slaves to harvest those resources.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know about that, but there's you're telling us that there's evidence to suggest that would have happened. And I get the dynamic that there was a strong belief that we are not going to be able to have one country without. There's just not room enough in this one country for one country and slavery as an institution. Those two things cannot coexist.
Right. Well, that's of course what Lincoln said, right? But house divided cannot stand.
But what was the urgency to maintain one country? Was it just Lincoln is saying, I don't want to be president, the president who lost half the country type of thing? I mean, or...
Well, that's an interesting, you know, there's some parallels between Lincoln and Churchill in some ways, and that's sort of what Churchill said, right? I didn't become prime minister to preside over the disintegration of the British Empire.
Right.
And there is, I mean, this is, all your questions are complicated, which is why they're good questions. There is, you know, Alexander Stevens, who was a sort of a friend of Lincoln, he was a congressman from Georgia, and they were on the same side during the Mexican War, that is, they were against it. And then Stevens became vice president of the Confederacy. And Stevens wrote after the war, for Mr. Lincoln, his devotion to the Union rose to the sublimity of religious mysticism. And I think that was a good insight. There was a kind of quasi-theistic commitment on Lincoln's part to the idea of the Union. That the manifest destiny, after all, that American exceptionalism, and you hear that in his greatest speeches, right? That the last best hope of earth. At Gettysburg, we've proven that a government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. He really did believe that the American experiment in self-rule was critical for human progress. Now, we know in our own time that people with certain kinds of ideals can countenance or go to war in order to prosecute those ideals. And maybe that's not the best basis for going to war, and maybe not the best basis for making policy. But that was there in Lincoln's mind, and that Lincoln was representing a significant sentiment in the nation, I have no doubt. And then, of course, there are also raw, hard material reasons. I mean, the American economy was already very interconnected. The trade via the waterways and the emerging railroads, it would have been a weaker nation with a weaker economy if it had been sundered in two. So there were all kinds of reasons for people to be in favor of union, from the highly idealistic to the almost messianic to the, hey, it's good for business to preserve the union. So all of these points came together, and one of the points I really try to drive home, and I think all historians should try to drive home, is that people were not clear in their own minds of why they fought what they fought. They had certain inherited points of view, and relatively few changed their minds in a fundamental way. They couldn't read the future. They didn't know what would happen next. Nobody had any clue what the scale of the carnage of the Civil War was right. going to be. So we can stand back and we can ask a lot of critical questions about them, and that's what we should be doing. But I do try in this book to convey the sense of bewilderment and confusion and anxiety that beset everybody, from the slave owners to the most committed abolitionists, as they were trying to figure out a way forward toward the world that they believed should come into being.
It's conceivable. I mean, if someone could come to Lincoln and say, look, I hope you think this is a good idea to maintain this union because, you know, 600,000 people are going to die to do so. He would have been like, Not the cost benefit analysis that I thought we were entering. I mean, it's right. Or did he have people around him that were saying maybe this is outside of your portfolio? But I mean, were there people around him who gave him like an estimate, like, okay, just so you know, I understand this is really important to you that we keep this country together, but this is the cost that's going to be associated with it. I mean, I don't know. It seems to me it would be really hard to conceive of that type of carnage at that point.
It was impossible to conceive of it because it was on a totally different scale from anything that anyone had ever experienced. And, you know, it's a cliche, but they say the generals are always fighting the last war.
Right.
You know, they were not anticipating a war with mechanized armaments, repeating rifles that are kind of the ancestors of today's automatic weapons, and deadly accurate artillery. And fighting on the scale that it emerged in the Civil War. I don't know that Lincoln had a war council where they were making estimates about casualties, but I do know that before the war really began, and even after Fort Sumter and before the first Battle of Bull Run, you get a lot of congressmen and senators standing up and saying, listen, this is going to blow over. They're going to come to their senses in a few months. The seceded states will be back and we'll be fine and we'll be back where we were. Status quo ante, you know, slavery will be part of the South and we'll be a union again. After Bull Run, when this 30,000 strong Union army was routed just south of Washington and the young boys came in a full-fledged panic, rushing through the streets, stumbling, trudging, barely able to walk in some cases, and the public came out, and a lot of them were secessionist sympathizers, and saw this army in complete chaos and disarray, they woke up to the reality. And you get Thaddeus Stevens from Pennsylvania standing up in the House and saying, this is going to be a long war. There are going to be many thousands of lives lost, and we need to dig in, and this is our lot, this is our fate, we have to prosecute this till it's done. And of course, as the war went on, generals like Grant and Sherman saw that in some ways it was a war of attrition, it was a war of destruction, and you said 600,000, that used to be the accepted number. Some historians now push it up to 750,000. And if you add the number of people who died after the war and the number of people who were mutilated psychologically as well as physically, it's almost impossible to comprehend the scale of the war. If you translate it into today's terms, it would be like 30 or 40 million people.
Wow.
Something to think about.
That's unbelievable. And had the Union said, okay, look, you guys, go ahead. God be with you. We will trade. You know, we'll have a border, and you'll be another country. I mean, and I understand the idea that, like, you know, there would have been every reason to believe at that point that the South is their economic engine is built on slavery and resource extraction, that they would have spent their money on boats and armaments, and instead of, you know, a war with the North, they would have gone south to expand. What do you, as a historian, like, is there any way in that counterfactual to sort of project, like, the institution of slavery? Would it have happened until essentially cotton had run out, or until sugar was replaced, or like where, what would have slowed that roll?
Hello? Yeah, I'm still here.
I'm sorry.
Sorry.
So what would,
go ahead.
What would have slowed that roll? It had the South taken their resources and gone south and taken over. What do you have a sense?
You're asking me a question that's, I don't know if fun is the right word, that's sort of irresistible to think about, but which is, of course, unanswerable.
Right.
I can say that the old school historians used to say that, well, the Civil War was a terrible waste and tragedy because slavery was burning itself out. It was economically unprofitable and so on. Younger historians, you mentioned Sven Becker, who's an excellent example, have taught us that slavery was extremely profitable and that it had within it a built-in impulse to expand. It had to expand in order to survive because the lands became infertile and new land was necessary, and more slaves were needed to cultivate the new lands. So there's no reason to believe that slavery would have petered out anytime soon if the war had not destroyed it. I will say, and you know, I say to my students, I'm in the confusion business. I think I know what I believe about certain basic moral and historical questions. I'm a huge admirer of Abraham Lincoln, who I think was every bit the deep thinker and the great leader that myth has made him out to be. But there is another point of view. And when I gave a talk in Washington not long after the fall of the Iron Curtain, as we used to call it in the early 90s, and I said some really nice things about Lincoln, and one of the members of the audience came up to me and said, Lincoln was the greatest war criminal in our history. Why did he have the right to force these people to stay in the Union when they didn't want to? And he was thinking of the analogy of the Soviet Union, which had tried to confine states within the Soviet Union that didn't want to be part of it. And, you know, that's a challenging question. It's a difficult historical question, and if we start thinking about analogies in our own time, when is it okay to compel people to remain in the Union? It raises all kinds of, you know, was the Constitution self-defined as a perpetual document? Was the Union designed to be something that could never be dissolved? The Founding Fathers actually kind of evaded that question and didn't address it directly. Well, Lincoln answered it. And with all of our problems today, I think most of the time when people say, well, California should secede, or the two borders should become their own nation, and mostly people aren't serious about that. And most of us find it hard to imagine that the United States will break up. But they found it hard to imagine in the 1850s, too. So who knows?
The book is The War Before the War, Fugitive Slaves and the Struggle for America's Soul from the Revolution to the Civil War. Andrew Del Banco, we will put a link to the book at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. It's fascinating stuff.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
All right, folks. Going to head to the fun half, wherein we will take your phone calls. We will take your IMs. Just a reminder that... that video, it's 90 minutes long. It'll be audio, obviously, for our audio members. We will put a link to it in the at majority.fm in the members post. And we should get that. We'll probably have that up by tomorrow. We just need to put a little something at the beginning of it. We will send it out to you if you are a member. It is 90 minutes long. let me just ask you guys this, because you've seen this. Like, do I need to apologize for being mean? Not to him. I would not apologize to him. And maybe this is a reveal. But I don't want like any of our audience to go like, I didn't think Sam was that mean.
Well, I've actually only seen maybe the first 5 minutes of it, so...
Jamie, from your perspective, am I, like, significantly meaner than you've seen me?
Maybe a little bit.
All right, so just a warning. I wasn't necessarily cantankerous, I don't want people to go like, oh, I don't feel comfortable now listening to the show.
No, you're bullying somebody. It was funny. Okay. You weren't like yelling at him. You were just being glib, which
I was being
is
a little
good.
Bit glib. And I will say this. I have since, after doing it, and, you know, I got an email from a listener after the fact saying, you should ask him about his gala reception at the Trump Tower, the Trump Hotel in Washington, that he charged $250 and $350 a plate for. And, you know, it came up in our conversation, but I didn't have time to really absorb it. And what I guess what I'm expressing is that I think that guy's a little bit more despicable than I gave him credit for. And if I had to do it over again, I would be meaner. Like, originally I was like, the guy, the poor guy, you know, whatever. He has a hope and a dream and this and that, and he's sort of a schmuck. But now I'm a little bit more like, this guy's...
It's not the right place, right time, right idiot.
It's yeah, more... now it's I'm a little bit more like, if I had to do that over again, like, because then I was like, eh. You know, I asked him, I said, at the beginning of the thing, I said, hey, can I get a copy of this? And they were like, sure. And they supposedly gave me permission to record it on my end, but it didn't work. Now, I'm also the type of person who would never enter into a conversation with someone like that and assume that they would record it on my behalf. So I also had a backup recording on my end. It's just a slightly different version of what they have, because you can actually see... I don't know how it is when they present it, if you can see who's waiting in the wings, but like sometimes you can hear the producer talking in my ear. And sometimes you can hear him. I think he's laughing. And I hope it's at Brandon. And
I mean, really, you're doing this guy a favor, because he is not cut out for this kind of work.
Oh, really? You should tell the $350,000 he's raised in less than a year.
He's more cut out than we are.
Not to mention what he made on that gala. I'm like, wait, what did you do with that 300 grand? And he goes, well, a gala's not free. And then I'm like, oh, okay. And then I realized, like, wait, no, you make money off the gala. And then I called him on it. He goes, well, so I'm smart. And I was like, yeah. Yeah, and then as that, like,
that's,
you know,
because I'm smart.
Because it was like an hour and 20 minutes into it, and I'm like, I got to get going. My sister's texting me, and, you know, I should go. I've got stuff to do. And so I did. I wasn't fully engaged.
Well, some of the things he said were too dumb for you to take seriously.
Yeah, I mean, some were like, that's the thing, is that I went into it with like, I'm just not going to, you know, try and explain to him, like, I'm not going to have big policy arguments with this guy.
You're not going to explain why Social Security is actually solvent?
Well, I'm always prepared to do that. I'm prepared to do that with, like, the guy at the hardware store or, you know, like, but.
Oh, and after all that, he got so upset that you compared him to Milo. He just posted pictures of himself with Milo, so.
He just did?
Yeah, there you go.
Well. There you go.
Trying to get a little of that stardust to rub off on him.
Yeah. Well, I explained to him, and he did express that maybe we were, or I was being homophobic because of that comparison. But I explained why we made that comparison, and it wasn't it was not necessarily for the reasons that I think he thought that I would say to his face. But all right. So. You can become a member and get this in your feed. We're not going to release it until tomorrow. So if you get a member by the time you hear this, you'll be good by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, this is the last day that you can get 30% off of Just Coffee. I just sent a bunch of Just Coffee to people I care about, basically as a way of enticing them to get hooked on the Majority Report blend. That's the way, I mean, I'm copping to my ulterior motives, because once you get somebody hooked, then but you can go with no coupon code, just go to justcoffee.coop, 30% off. Tomorrow night is Michael Brooks show. You can find that on patreon.com/TMBS or on his YouTube channel, TMBS. But he's not here to hype it, so fine. But if you want to go see a live Majority Report, but our tickets are sold out, you can at the very least, you know, downgrade and see the Michael Brooks show live in Brooklyn in February. Information is on our website at majorityreportradio.com. It's fun to do this when he's not here, to say this stuff, because he doesn't. Yeah, here's a picture of it. There it is, the Michael Brooks show live, Friday, February 1st.
I'll be there, folks.
Matt will be there.
So,
I mean, and maybe, you know, we may stop by. I don't know. Michael might stop by. I might do my own VIP gathering out in front of the venue for $125 per person.
I think you should crash it like Offset crashed Cardi B's show over the weekend.
I saw that. I can't believe that. It was really inappropriate.
A little bit. A little bit, yeah.
Well, you don't do that in front of, like, that's a bullying.
That's dangerous male behavior.
Exactly. Anyways.
That's why Sam's going to do it to Mike.
That's right. I may get up in the middle of the show and go, hey, everybody, I'm doing a show right across the street, totally free, but it's happening right now. Jamie, what's happening on the Antifada?
I'm so glad you asked. So as regular listeners of the show know by now, last week was a very serious episode on immigration, where we kind of take apart piece by piece some of the faux populist arguments being made by people like Angela Nagel, Tucker Carlson, and friends. So this week, we decided to do something a little bit more silly. We had on Alex Patak of Pod Damn America, who is a very funny guy. And we talked about some union news. We talked about the Amazon warehouse organizing. We talked about the New York Magazine Union and how Jonathan Chait is a crybaby scab who opposed it. We talked about how Penthouse Magazine is like alt-right now and what other magazines are going to become some weird extreme political formation in the near future.
Did you talk about Teen Vogue?
We did, yes. That's the other thing, right? Like Penthouse is alt-right. Teen Vogue is written by leftists pretty much. So like, what's next? We'll see. And then I think it's going to be a bonus, but we talked about a bad liberal YouTuber and her poor analysis of films. So check it out.
Matt?
Yeah, Literary Hangover, the Democracy in Chains episode is up. Also, I did Anne Bradstreet over the weekend, and she not only was the first published poet of America, but the first political pundit as well. So that'll be up on Friday. Maybe a bit early for members.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the... Oh, and we should also say Kyle's with us today. Well, way to speak up, Kyle. All right, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.